St. Joseph, you can see lots of things, like the home of Jesse James or the Pony Express Museum. But perhaps you've missed the Glor Psychiatric Museum. This offbeat attraction houses artifacts from a time when the treatment of mental illness relied on institutionalization. In hospitals, where there was little hope of a cure, advances in medicine and improved understanding of mental illness have changed that picture, but the role that friends and family can play in addressing a mental health crisis has become more complicated. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we'll explore the history and perceptions of mental health treatment. Join our conversation after this news. Good morning, I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we'll look at the history of intervention in mental health crises going all the way back to the 19th century. Just day trip distance north of here in St. Joseph, Missouri, the Glor Psychiatric Museum, formerly known as State Lunatic Asylum No. 2, captures both the treatments of the past and the controversies they sparked. We'll talk with a panel of experts about how professional practice and public perception have evolved since the days of State Lunatic Asylum No. 2. We may even find out how that history plays into some of the current debates surrounding mental health care. Later in the hour, stay tuned for our Tell KCUR series, where we'll share your summer job stories. For now, I'd like to start by introducing Sarah Elder. She's curator of collections at the Glor Psychiatric Museum. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you today?
Great. How about you?
Oh, just fine, thanks. Thank you for having me on the show.
No problem. We're glad you're here. For people who haven't been to the Glor Psychiatric Museum in St. Joseph, can you give a basic overview of what it is and why it exists?
Well, it was actually started as a small exhibit, public display for Mental Health Awareness Week in the 1960s, and it just grew from there, and it is now four stories in one building. And the founder of the museum, George Glor, his goal was to not just illustrate the history of the State Lunatic Asylum No. 2, as it was originally known, but also the treatment of the mentally ill and how it has evolved over time and just exactly how far we have come since the 19th century. And he was also trying to help reduce the stigma that has been associated with those individuals that have mental illness.
Tell us a little bit more about the history of the asylum itself and the thoughts surrounding mental illness that it represented.
Well, the asylum itself was built and opened in November of 1874. And at that time, I know that the phrase lunatic asylum, and we get this from visitors a lot, is like, oh my. But at the time of the 19th century, lunatic or lunacy were medically designated terms. And asylum was more of a place of sanctuary. If you put it in the connotation of how we use the phrase political asylum, as opposed to a mental asylum. So that's how that phrase got started here. And it was, unfortunately, not just those people with mental illness were brought out here.
Those yeah, explain that.
It was individuals with tuberculosis were brought out here as kind of an isolation. Basically, it was those individuals who didn't fit what society considered to be normal.
Well, we have in the studio someone who would like to weigh in on this, Dr. Rob Hornstra from UMKC's Center for Behavioral Medicine and Psychiatry. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning. There were also a lot of people whose brain and nervous system was infected with syphilis that developed symptoms, neurological and psychiatric. And at that time, there was not a cure for that disease.
Yeah. And Sarah, there is actually an exhibit at the Glor Psychiatric Museum that has sort of a fever-inducing mechanism, I believe, for those patients.
Yes, that is correct. We did have a lot of syphilis patients were brought out here as well. The doctor is correct. But we have two fever cabinets. And these particular items were used to raise the body temperature as a treatment, and the temperature could be raised to like 105 degrees, and this treatment would go over several days, and that high temperature killed the syphilis bacteria in its early stages. Advanced stages, there was no cure in the advanced stages of syphilis, and those individuals did remain patients out here at the hospital.
There are different kinds of displays at the Glor, among them contraptions that were once used in the treatment of mental illness, such as those fever cabinets, with accompanying text to explain why and how these devices were used. Could you pick a couple of other contraptions to tell us about to kind of set the scene?
Well, the original exhibits for the display for Mental Health Awareness Week involved restraint cages. And many of those patients who were violent were put into these restraint cages, and that's exactly what they look like, as opposed to the straight jackets that more people are familiar with. So we do have some replicas and a couple of actual ones, one of which was used at the Missouri State Asylum in Fulton, Missouri, that opened in 1851. It was donated up here several years ago, and it is a metal restraint cage. We also have a display of lobotomy equipment and how lobotomies came to be around in a surgical setup.
Can you, just in case some of our listeners don't know what a lobotomy actually is, can you describe that procedure briefly?
Well, there were a couple of different ways to do a lobotomy. Originally, it was go neurosurgery, go into the brain, and disconnect the tissues of the frontal lobe, excuse me, from the rest of the brain. And then Dr. Walter Freeman came on the scene, and he was convinced that performing lobotomies on the majority of patients with mental illness would cure them. But the way that the previous surgery was done took too long, was too expensive. So he developed the transorbital lobotomy or ice pick lobotomy. And that was just, not to put too fine a point on it, and it's a little graphic, but an ice pick type instrument or something called a leukotome would be inserted under the orbital bone and then basically turned or twisted. And that would disconnect the connective tissues between the frontal lobe and the rest of the brain. And this became very dominant throughout the country in the 1940s, 50s, and a little bit into the 60s.
Yeah, and the display there kind of walks you through the changing attitudes toward it with some visual accompaniment. But, you know, I hadn't visited the museum in a while, and I went to see these exhibits yesterday to have them fresh in my mind. And what really stood out to me as an overarching theme is human fallibility. Professionals with the best intentions make mistakes and are subject to all kinds of biases, which can play out quite dramatically in the treatment of mental illness. Could you talk a little bit about that?
You're right. Human nature is what it is. And the doctors we'll just start with the start of the hospital out here in 1874, were doing the best they could with the knowledge that they had at the time. To our 21st century eyes and sensibilities, these treatments and devices look to a certain extent almost barbaric in nature, but by and large, the medical professionals and the nurses and the orderlies were really doing the best they could for the patients that were here. To kind of put it into perspective, I tell visitors when they come here that think about 140 years from now, how individuals would view our forms of treatment as we view those of 140 years from now. The advances, I mean, medical treatment in all aspects, not just in mental illness, but it does keep advancing as we learn more and more about the brain and about mental illness.
Well, there's a traveling exhibit at the Glor Psychiatric Museum called Gray Matters, created by local artists who wanted to explore the stigma surrounding mental illness, especially the gendered aspect of that stigma. One of the artists who organized that exhibit is here with us in the studio. Good morning, Marguerite Perre.
Good morning.
So tell me about this exhibit, Gray Matters.
Well, Gray Matters is an elaboration of one of the Waiting Room projects, a series of multidisciplinary visual arts, text, sound, and performance-based arts projects that explore healthcare, medical history, and personal narrative. The lead artists on Gray Matters are myself, Bruce Schurting, Stephanie Lanter, and Robin Lasser, who contributed the sound piece. Gray Matters is also a collaboration with the Glor Museum. So in addition to the artist-made pieces, we've incorporated a number of the objects and images from the collections of the museum, the Glor Museum. And you're right, it is it does have a very heavy focus on gender-based biases, how women were treated in the institutions and why they were institutionalized.
There's a digital slideshow you see when you first enter the room, and some of the slides you see are old note cards with some basic information about female patients. What are those? Where did they come from?
Those are patient admission logs that were from the Topeka State Hospital and also the Iowa Psychopathic Hospital. And psychopathic sounds like a very upsetting word, but actually it was considered very scientific at the time of that hospital's opening in 1910 because it just meant mental illness, if you break it out.
So that's the terminology that we come to after we've left behind perhaps lunatic.
Yes. So that's a little bit after. The Topeka State Hospital, which was originally the state asylum, was very much on the same kind of building and was very much at the same time as the St. Joseph Hospital or the Silent Number 2.
So these note cards, tell us about some of the characters they represent and how you found them.
Well, I actually went to the state archives in both cases, and I did research into the actual logs, the patient logs. And what I found was a lot of biases towards both women and anybody who wasn't white, heterosexual, and male, and middle or upper class. So you do find a lot of that, and Christian. So all of those things. But in terms of the female patients, there's a lot of cases that you can easily read into. Any women who are sexually active but not married or became pregnant were termed sexual psychopaths and often committed. There were some cases where the individual 19-year-old house servant is committed and for those reasons, and then you have to take into consideration what might have happened in that household. So I found them extremely interesting but also upsetting to think back to those stories.
There was a woman I recall she was admitted partly based on she had lost interest in housework.
Right. Well, and that would have been one of the reasons why, not performing the roles that had been assigned to women and moving outside of them. A very famous woman, and this is somebody who lived in central Illinois in the mid-19th century, was Elizabeth Packard Ware. And she was committed after 21 years of marriage by her husband because her husband was a minister. And she started disagreeing with some of his sermons, and she had a more liberal point of view. And so that's why she was committed and then had to fight rigorously to get out. And then actually eventually was very crucial to enacting legislation in Illinois where people would be guaranteed a trial before being committed.
We'll be revisiting this idea of involuntary commitment to a mental institution in a moment, but how did you feel personally as a woman in the 2000 teens stumbling upon these stories?
I felt that I felt a great deal of compassion and empathy for those individuals. I felt like I was hearing stories, and they were coming very clearly through to me through these, through these logs that are over 100 years old. I also felt that, frankly, there are still a lot of biases in how women are treated in all aspects of the healthcare system, and especially I think there's still a lot of biases about women and hysteria and over-complaining in the mental health area.
Is there some very specific kind of connection you're able to draw between maybe terminology of today and terminology you encountered in this research?
The terminology used at that time, most of those, hysteria, of course, was one of those things that was used at that time. But a lot of the terminology would seem very antiquated and wouldn't be familiar at all right now. So I guess not quite with the terminology, but I do think that there's a persistence of these biases that come through.
Those note cards that you talked about are interspersed in the slideshow with text from the yellow wallpaper. Can you tell us about that text?
So the yellow wallpaper was a very important and influential feminist text by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who was born in the mid-19th century and lived into 1935. And she discusses, well, it's a fictionalized version of something that happened to her. She had a child, and she had postpartum depression, which is not uncommon. And at that time, the popular treatment was the rest cure. And that was the idea for that was, and was generally applied mostly towards women, that you would be set aside, bed rest, you couldn't have any intellectual stimulation, and it just made her feel worse. It made her feel horrible, and she felt like she was going to really become totally insane if she kept continuing with that. So she stopped that treatment. But in the story, the husband is the doctor, and he has control over her both as the doctor and the husband. And the woman in the story does become psychotic.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman. You've just been hearing the voice of Marguerite Perret, a local artist who is one of the minds behind Gray Matters, an exhibit at the Glore Psychiatric Museum. But I'd like to turn now to Dr. Rob Hornstra, with us from UMKC's Center for Behavioral Medicine and Psychiatry. Welcome back to the conversation, Dr. Hornstra.
Thank you.
Dr. Hornstra, it does sound like at various points in our history, lots of things were considered mental illness that were really just examples of people being different in some way.
Absolutely. Even today, you know, there are certain, you know, many people feel that have a different sexual preference other than heterosexual, is there must be something wrong with this person.
What are some other examples historically of groups of people who might have been committed to mental health institutions based on who they were rather than a diagnosis?
I'm really not sure. But I'm, you know, historically it would also be, I do think it would be people that had some impairment, and or people that were born with less ability to learn, people that we might have called mentally retarded in the past. Now we would say that they have some cognitive disabilities.
Could you walk us through the history of hospitalization for mental illness? It's not looked upon favorably these days, but it was once fairly common.
Sure it was. And at one point it was, I mean, let me go back further and sort of and think about Europe or any other small town in the United States. If there was maybe one person who was retarded, they might be cared for by the person in the community, and there was no need for some other structures for them. If there was someone who had a mental illness, that they might have also had support, help, assistance from the other people. Yeah, he's just a bit off over there, but we, you know, he's okay. And so sometimes this could be managed within a community. As society changed, there became more, and in Europe, they became more and more in need to deal with the mentally ill people. And as I spoke before, the people that had neurological disorders, the people that had neurosyphilis, and people that were addicted to various medicines, not medicine, to opiates, to smoking opium, that were also alcoholics. Some places developed asylums, which was a safe place for these people to be kept.
Sarah Elder, do you want to weigh in on this? Any milestones in the early history of hospitalization for mental illness or this idea about who is admitted and why?
Well, Dr. Hornstra is correct. Any people who consider to be different, as I said before, tuberculosis patients, syphilis patients, those who Down syndrome, individuals with a physical deformity, such as maybe a club foot or maybe a cleft palate, things that didn't appear to what was considered normal by society, would be brought out here. We talk about, in talking about women, it was not unheard of for, like I said, for a woman who decided that her husband was wrong on some things. And they would just be brought out here with very few questions asked. And as the doctor said, it was just a case of or maybe we can't handle this individual anymore, or this individual, Alzheimer's, dementia, would bring them out here. Drug addicts, alcoholics also were brought out here for treatment.
What, Dr. Hornstra, were some of the goals of hospitalization? Was the idea that people would be cured?
In a way. There was, at various times, a movement where it was believed that if people had safe surroundings, if they were able to give in a role to help the place they were staying, if they were part of that, they learned skills, they learned how to get along with people, they were treated nice, and so some of the mental institutions in the United States were built on the architectural design of a man named Kirkbride, who believed in the very nice hotel-like hospitals that with big wooden staircases and big open areas within the building.
Where were these?
Well, I think Missouri had at least one or two Kirkbride buildings in their hospitals, but you know, we're talking East Coast moving on west. Yes.
Okay. And what was it that started changing the public's attitude toward these institutions? What was that? Because this isn't something that continues to be accepted or even preferred.
A couple of things happened, and I think there was, and before there even was treatment for mental illness, there was the recognition maybe that there was, as we discovered some treatment for syphilis, those people didn't need to be in mental hospitals anymore. They could be going to a regular hospital. They could get their treatment. They could be in a nursing home, you know, things like that. And, in our state, the mental health division split into various pieces. And so one of the divisions ended up being a disabilities retardation division that developed its own asylums for mentally retarded people. And at that time, they instead of calling them rehabilitation centers, they called them habilitation centers, knowing that it wasn't like at one point someone was totally functional. No, they had not been functional most of their life, and so they didn't, and so they needed habilitation. They needed to start at zero, many of these people, and learn those skills.
And this terminology, again, we're using terminology that maybe people in the present day are fairly uncomfortable with, and you're using it because that was the terminology of the time?
Yes.
Okay, just checking. And then, so what, Sarah Elder, what were some of the milestones as you see them as far as people's attitudes toward institutionalization for mental illness changing?
Well, as Dr. Hornstra mentioned, the Kirkbride building, the original buildings for the St. Joseph State Hospital were based on the Kirkbride plan. So from the beginning, that was kind of a new thing, was to have the open air with huge windows to let in natural light. So that was the first milestone, to have one of the first Kirkbride buildings west of the Mississippi. And then it continued on. We had superintendents in the early 20th century who believed in occupying a patient's brain and occupying them physically. And because the hospital was a working farm, many of these patients worked the farm. So it was occupational therapy before that was the phrase.
And Dr. Hornstra, you're expressing some enthusiasm for this idea.
Yes, when I visited there, I was really, I loved that I could. I saw some milk jugs, and I said, "Where'd these come from?" "Oh, those came from our dairy." "Well, who did the milking?" "Oh, the patients milked the cows." "Oh, okay." "And where did these other things come from?" "Oh, that we had farm fields here, and we grew our own potatoes, so we had our own potatoes." And I kept talking to Mr. Glore at that time, and he explained that the hospital was almost self-sufficient. They didn't grow a lot of wheat because they didn't have their own mill, but they did need to bring in flour. They needed to bring in sugar. But otherwise, you know, they had chickens, they had eggs, they had milk, they grew vegetables and fruits as well.
And so, Sarah...
Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to encourage you to continue.
Well, we also had cattle. There was a hog farm on the hospital. There were apple trees, walnut trees. The state hospital grounds were extremely extensive. All told, at some point, there was maybe about 1,700 acres associated with the hospital. So
So we'll find out what it did shortly. But Dr. Hornstra, looking back at this period, there's also this issue of involuntary commitment. And Marguerite brought that up when she was looking at these.
Yeah, it just seemed like people could just bring you there and sign you in, and that was it. And the issue of patient rights and the rights of people came about as people began leaving state hospitals and flourished. As a topic and an understanding toward the 60s, in the 60s. And most states rewrote their mental health laws probably once in the late 60s or early 70s, and then again at the end of the decade. For example, at the time that I was a medical student, all it took was a couple of professionals they didn't even need to be a doctor. They could, like a couple nurses or a nurse and a medical student could sign what they called a green sheet, which could keep you in the hospital for up to 72 hours.
And nowadays we hear some talk about people wishing that they were able to intervene in someone else's mental health crisis with a little bit more agency. But it seems like there's a long history of explanation for why that doesn't exist.
Well, it was abusive, yes. People were kept, you know, some people with anorexia were green sheeted and had a tube put down their nose and throat and fed against their will right away without any negotiation.
And what is the current attitude toward this?
Toward
commitment? Toward commitment, toward a patient's rights
in
this.
Well, I think that people have rights to refuse treatment, and the current laws are such that, and some people would say it's too hard of a rule, but in most states there is a requirement that the person be dangerous to themselves or others and have a mental illness.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be talking more with Dr. Hornstra, Marguerite Perret, and Sarah Elder of the Glor Psychiatric Museum. Central Standard will return shortly. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Controversy surrounding the treatment of mental illness is nothing new. Today, debate swirls around warning labels on antidepressants. National news sheds light on jails serving as the only refuge for some sufferers of mental illness. This morning, we're looking back at the history of mental health controversy, particularly with respect to mental institutions also called asylums, among other things. Our guests are Sarah Elder from the Glor Psychiatric Museum in St. Joseph, Missouri, artist Marguerite Perret, and Dr. Rob Hornstra of UMKC's Center for Behavioral Medicine and Psychiatry. Dr. Hornstra, you have not only professional expertise in this history, but a personal connection through your father. Could you tell us about your father?
I would be greatly pleased to do so. My father was an immigrant. He also was a psychiatrist. He came here from Holland, and why did he do that? Well, this was after World War II. He had finished his medical school. He did an internship, and then he thought, well, there's a hospital that's advertising that they'll hire me in Kansas City and give me a free passage on this ship to go there, and he did. Unfortunately, he arrived here penniless because his last $5 were used by a barber in Chicago who gave him too many different services and spent all of his money. Shoe shine, massage, all that kind of stuff. So
he was had.
Yes, he was. And then, so he arrived and took a cab from Union Station to the hospital that had hired him. And he asked them, he walked into the hospital and said, "You need to go and pay the cab."
So he worked in the mental health field.
He eventually, he got some more medical training and he eventually trained at the General Hospital here, which is now Truman Medical Center. At that time, it was General Hospital number one. And he also worked some at General Hospital number two. This was a time of segregation. Number two was for African Americans. Number one was for white people. So, yes, he trained to be a psychiatrist there. And under the auspices, we didn't have our own medical school at that time, but he trained under the auspices of the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri at that time, and became a psychiatrist. He ended up being a giant in mental health here. He was one of the leaders at that time. They had a city-operated mental health center that was called the PRC, Psychiatric Receiving Center, which is a place that police could bring people that were having trouble. And then if they needed to, they could. There was a bus that came and took people to the hospital in St. Joseph.
So what? Tell us a little bit more about this PRC. How long was it in existence?
Well, its original existence as a city hospital, but with President Kennedy's Mental Health Center Act, it became a lot more. It became...
And that's 1963, right?
Correct. It was about a month before he died, was assassinated. So it's very important contribution because this gave federal money to communities who were willing to build what was called a comprehensive community mental health center. What that meant was that it wasn't just a hospital where you put people in, and it wasn't just an office where people came to get counseling. This was a place where you had a whole range of services, and they began building that. And in fact, that entity got an award from the American Psychiatric Association in 1962 for the being innovative. They had at that time what was called a day hospital, as well as inpatients. So some people were brought by their family to get help. They weren't so ill that they needed to stay in the hospital, but they could be in the day hospital and get treatment and then go home to their family at night. And then some people might need to be in the hospital for a while, but then could transition to day hospital and then go back to their hospital at night. And so it provided a whole range of care.
The kind of establishment that came out of Kennedy's Act in 1963, could you remind us the name of that act?
The Community Mental Health Center Act.
So these community mental health centers, tell us about those. How long did they exist and do we have
they
any?
They still do, yes. The organization, I need to do a little more history. The state-operated PRC, now the city-operated PRC, became a state-operated organization in 63, 64, and began to get the federal funding, did some rehab to the original PRC, and were... Since they were successful as one of the first entities in Kansas City to integrate, they were able to excite everyone else, and General Hospital 2 was emptied. And so by 1971, the state bought General Hospital number 2, which was across the street from the PRC, and combined the PRC and General Hospital number 2 into what became at that time Western Missouri Mental Health Center. And it was the beginning of the building of a whole comprehensive empire of inpatient, outpatient, group homes, apartments.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman, joined by a few guests to talk about the history of mental health care in our area and in society in general. We are joined by a handful of guests, and among them is Sarah Elder, who is from the Glor Psychiatric Museum. Hi, Sarah. Welcome back to the show.
Gina. So, thank you so much. Sorry about that. We've got some storms rooting through. So.
It's understandable. Sarah, as you listen to Dr. Hornstra speaking, how does this history bear out in the Glor Psychiatric Museum?
It pretty much follows along the timelines as he was saying. Overcrowding of the mental institutions was a nationwide problem, and St. Joseph State Hospital was no exception. But really, in the 1960s, before the act was passed, the superintendent, he just was like, you know, like this is a treatment for the mentally ill, and those individuals who, for instance, tuberculosis patients or things, places that they didn't need to be here. He started kind of downsizing and said, you know, many of the patients were sent to group homes or community-based homes or community care. Many were returned to their families because it wasn't necessary for them to be in an institution. So through the 1960s and into the 70s, it became more of a community-based rather than this huge institution, which just after World War II had almost 3,000 patients in it.
You know, something else about the time period around World War II, I noticed at your museum that music therapy became popular at the museum around that time. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Music therapy has always been here at the State Hospital. Really all that changes is the instruments. But so, you know, we went from the earlier, you know, from pianos to electric guitars and drum sets. And the patients, there would be bands formed, and they would perform at dances for the other patients to participate in, perform concerts that would be open to the public to come in. And there's the old phrase of music hath charms to soothe the savage beast. And there's just something about music that can speak to various individuals, including those with mental illness, that can help in their treatment.
So that's
we try to show that here.
Yeah, that's a therapy that's kind of therapy that's ongoing. Some of the other therapies, as we discussed before, are not quite so ongoing. A display that kind of interested me was the display of dental treatments for mental illness.
There was some thought at the time that something to do with the teeth could affect the brain, so teeth would be pulled, drilled on, rather than just the regular dental care, which would later be provided. It was just one of those schools of thought that was fairly popular at the time. So just trying this, okay, if we take care of this person's teeth, remove them, then the brain will start thinking in the correct manner.
Also on display there is art by patients, and some of that art is in fact historic, produced by patients in previous eras, and some of it is very recent, produced by people who are experiencing and being treated for mental illness of various kinds. Could you talk a little bit about the art created by the patients?
We have examples of artwork from patients that runs the gamut of the medium. Honestly, as we tell visitors, if you can think of an arts and crafts project, it was probably done here as part of art therapy. We have more traditional paintings, acrylics, oils. We have things made out of what were then known as pipe cleaners, but chenille stems is what they're called now, sculptures from plaster, embossed tin and copper, punched tin and copper. With string art, which was really big in the 1960s and 70s. We've got a couple of examples of that. The artwork's beautiful, and I do not have – my stick figures don't like stick figures, so I am in awe. You know, I am in awe of artwork in and of itself, but we don't know the background of a lot of the patients due to privacy laws, but in one case, there was a gentleman. We have a couple of his portraits on display. One is of a still life that is gorgeous. And what we were told by Mr. Glor, who knew him, was that this individual did not have the cognitive ability to really get dressed on his own. He wasn't quite sure what was supposed to go first, but he could create these beautiful pieces. And admittedly, I do not have the psychological background, but to my mind, it's almost like the brain was compensating in some way. And you know, that may be a little naive on my part, but the artwork is just gorgeous.
You know, Sarah, there's this one particular work of art that was created by a woman who was who didn't speak, and she had been diagnosed with schizophrenia. And the last time I visited the museum, it was presented in a certain way. But I guess since then, more research has been done, and there's a new attitude toward her and toward her creation. Can you talk a little bit about her story, the silent patient?
The little bit that we do know is, as what you said, it was a female patient who was diagnosed with schizophrenia. And as you said, she didn't communicate in any way until one day, and we're not sure when or how long she was a patient here before it occurred to somebody. Somebody gave her a pillowcase and a needle and embroidery thread. And she just started to embroider. And at the time, you know, we don't know how many she did because they were just thrown away. Until somebody thought, oh, the Glore Museum might want an example of this. So we have this example, and it was just originally thought that these were just these random thoughts that she heard in her head or maybe heard in conversations going on around her, because it runs from different phrases to song lyrics. A student, I believe it was at an Indiana university, and his advisor came and did it. They called it an analysis of a silent voice. And basically, the study was that these were not random thoughts. This was her communicating. And I'll apologize. It's been a while since I've read the results of his study, so I may misquote some of the things.
And the study was 2010, right?
Yes. And these types of communication could be used to assist in the treatment of this particular patient or of someone with a similar diagnosis. As I said, again, it's been a while since I've read what that study said, but that kind of shows us in the 1970s when the museum got this is how the thinking was, but now 30 years later, this is not just random. This is how this patient is communicating. And as I said, it runs from things of, I am lonely, wait for me, when are you coming for me, to, you better watch out, you better not pout, Santa Claus is coming to town.
Dr. Hornstrow, when you hear stories like this and when you yourself think about the history that's captured in the Glore Psychiatric Museum, what are the lessons for us today, either specific lessons or just maybe sort of conceptual guiding principles?
Well, I would there might be a few things, but what comes to my mind is that whether you want to call someone who's in the hospital, whether you call them a patient, a client, or whatever, they're people. They live a life. They exist in the world, and we need to understand that, and that's very important. And so their personage is a lot more important than their diseasehood.
Interesting. How does that play into your actual approach to treatment or current ideas about treatment?
Well, I want mental health professionals or any mental health worker to talk to a person that is seeking help or is being forced to get help, just like they, you know, respectfully, you know, ask them how they would like. Should you call them by their first name? They feel more comfortable if you call them by their last name. Or some people will tell me that they don't like their first name and give me what they prefer to use as how I should address them.
So involving them in the treatment.
Yeah, well, yes, they have to be a part of it. I strongly believe that, and have always have, but clearly there have been times when medicine has looked at things differently, and it was all doctor-focused, and there wasn't patient focus. And patient focus is extremely important, and as well as the overall concept for all of our society to learn more about, you know, we sort of have this attitude that's beginning to change, that we're born, we're fine, we're healthy, and we can just do what we want for the rest of our life. And until, oh, something happens, we're sick. Okay, we go to a doctor. I would like us to move away from that model and say, well, so far I'm okay, but, you know, I need to know about how to stay healthy, and I need to know what to eat, how to spend my time, what to learn, You know, and so that I would like everyone, or at least our society, promote this idea of self-care. Not that you don't go see doctors, yes, but you do what you can to keep your mind healthy and to keep the other parts of it healthy as well.
I also hear you kind of saying that the person before the illness and the person who becomes ill, to see that more as one person rather than become someone else and now you go live somewhere else.
No, because just because doesn't mean you're not as smart as you used to be. Sometimes with some mental illnesses, I mean, there are many times that you might not be able to think as fast during the time that you're most ill, and you might lose some ability to do certain things you were able to do before. However, just because you have a mental illness doesn't mean you're stupid.
Well, that is all the time we have for this fascinating conversation about mental health history. Thanks so much to Dr. Rob Hornstra, Sarah Elder from the Glore Psychiatric Museum, and artist Marguerite Perret. I'm sorry I tripped over that, for joining me today. I so appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I feel humbled to be with these people.
Now we're going to lighten the mood a bit with a weekly Tell KCUR segment exploring summer jobs. For this segment, I'm joined by KCUR's social media producer, Allison Rollitz. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Gina.
So what did you ask our listeners this week?
Well, Gina, with the official start of summer coming up this Saturday, we wanted to know what was your best or worst summer job, and we asked listeners, what did you learn from the job?
I feel like this is a good one. Okay, so what are some of the best jobs?
We got a lot of good ones, and this probably is no surprise to any of the parents out in Kansas City, but we had a lot from Worlds of Fun. I think it ends up being a mecca for teenagers for seasonal work during the summer. And we had a lot of people kind of tweet in responses, but we really liked this one from April. She talks about her job at a greenhouse working on all the exotic plants they need for all of the different worlds at Worlds of Fun.
And she wrote, thought of that.
I know. It's a little weird. But she wrote, I worked alone frequently and loved the feeling of inner peace and strength gained from my early mornings among the plants, heat, humidity, and solitude. And Gina, just coming from a former Oceans of Fun employee when I was a teenager, felt any of those things. It was always just hot. There were lots of boys and girls flirting with each other, and it was just a nice kind of high-paying teenage job. But you never felt solitude or serenity.
But this listener did.
This listener did, definitely. We also had a couple other cool jobs come in. Carla tells us on Twitter about her job as a tour guide in St. Louis for Anheuser-Busch, which sounds pretty awesome. And in addition to asking people to call in or to tweet or Facebook us, we actually went out to the Luce Park Country Club Plaza area yesterday, and we asked some people some things. So here's actually a pretty cool job about an iconic summer treat.
Best summer job is working at Dairy Queen. Back when I was coming out of high school and going into college, it was a lot of fun. I got to work with a lot of kids that were in my age group also going to school. It was just fun. Who doesn't like ice cream in the summertime?
The social advantages of the summer job cannot be underestimated. But what were some of the worst jobs? Because you asked for best or worst.
Definitely. Most were tied to hard labor, particularly assembly lines. On Facebook, Deanie laments a job on an assembly line placing bacon on yellow cardboard. We had someone complaining about a potato chip line in Liberty, Missouri. And then on Twitter, Dee said his worst summer job was being a hospital janitor. Quote, it's as bad as it sounds. And back out by the plaza, we heard about this summer job involving soap, of all things.
My worst summer job was probably scraping soap off of the floor at Indigo Wild. I had to scrape all the soap and mop it down, and it was fun, but it was really hard.
Well, I'm glad she still thought it was fun. And, you know, I guess that does lead to the point that when I personally think about this question, I feel like I've had a couple of jobs that might qualify as simultaneously best and worst. Did any of our listeners report an experience kind of like that?
Yes. Yeah. Diana, actually, particularly, she talks to us on Facebook about a job she had at a construction warehouse one summer. She said while it was physically demanding and really draining, she said, quote, "It gave me a respect and appreciation for those who do this work their entire lives. It also taught me skills that have served me well many times since then, such as how to read blueprints and how to use power tools. Insert manly grunt here."
We've inserted it. I think we can all insert it in our minds because I'd rather not emulate it. So were there really surprising jobs, anything cool or interesting that you wouldn't have expected?
Yes. On Facebook, Roberta tells us about a summer she spent at Argonne National Laboratory in Illinois. It was on a forest preserve, and she did acid rain research. She said she ate lunch at a waterfall on a local stream every day. So that definitely stood out. And then this was probably the funniest one. Sean said he on Twitter, he interned with the Kansas City Symphony erasing pencil marks in books of sheet music several years back.
Wouldn't have thought that existed.
Definitely. I wonder if he got paid. And then we actually had the founding producer of Morning Edition, Jay Kernis. He sent us a really nice email describing the summer job that landed him his first gig with NPR in the 1970s. It actually started at a New York public radio station. He said he was the only person that told us how much he made back then, and it was $1.75 an hour for winding audio carts, sorting mail, and doing all sorts of things. He eventually worked at NPR for 21 years, but he says, quote, "There was nothing like those summers when the door to an entire new world had opened, when you edited sound with a razor blade." He's now the producer of CBS News Sunday Morning.
Well, Allison, we have just a moment left, so maybe a last word on life lessons, because that we did ask that, but we are going to have to get out shortly.
Sure. We heard this wonderful phone call from Sally in Leavenworth, Kansas. She had a really interesting life lesson.
My most memorable summer job was as a summer recreation counselor and swimming instructor at Fort Sam Houston, Texas, the summer after my freshman year in college. About halfway into the job, my father was killed in a car accident. I'll never forget this. Two little girls took it upon themselves to come and visit me regularly after my father died. They were my consolers and my friends. The thing that I learned from that job was that never underestimate the kindness of children.
Wow, that's powerful. Well, Allison, thanks so much. I look forward to doing this again next week.
Thank you, Gina. Really
in the country,
thanks so much for joining us today for Central Standard. Tune in tomorrow for Central Standard Fridays with host Russ Simmons and the Movie Critics. To listen back to today's show or any of our past conversations, visit us online at kcur.org/centralstandard. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, along with interns Christina Leffring and Matt Hodapp. Linda Sherrod runs the board for us every day. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's all for today's show. Stick around for Up to Date next.